I'm Edwina Farley and this is A Country Breakfast on RN. This morning it's an Easter feast of chocolate and lunar wine.
We are at about a three-quarter moon, so that we well away from unwelcome influences from a full moon. We're away from an impending lunar eclipse. Also, it's apogee, so the moon's influence is minimal. We see that as a way to make sure we have good concentration in the fruit.
Deciphering the ins and outs of making biodynamic wine in the midst of a Canberra vineyard a little later. First though, let's find out the news of the week. Kath McAloon joins us. Morning, Kath.
Good morning, Edwina.
Now, this is not the sexiest of news stories, but the release this week of Ian Harper's competition review has some pretty significant implications for farmers.
It's being hailed as one of the biggest shake-ups of Australia's economy in more than 20 years. The recommendations are huge and they're varied, and some industries are worried about the impact if the federal government does change the law, as has been recommended. For farmers, it could mean they'd have more flexibility to collectively bargain. So the proposal would see similar small businesses being able to group together in negotiations with processors. And the ACCC has recently allowed dairy farmers and poultry producers and potato growers to bargain collectively, but it has been limited because of laws against price setting. And the National Farmers Federation's Tony Maher says that if this was adopted by the government, this recommendation for collective bargaining, it could lead to big changes for farmers and it could allow them to boycott particular markets.
Instead of accepting a price, they would potentially get together and say, well, we're not going to accept that price and we would boycott that market. And I think there's a series of provisions that would need to go with that. But it effectively allows them to, again, have that scale and a bit more balance in the marketplace.
One of the other key elements of this, when we sort of look at market power and in particular the dominance of the two major supermarkets, was something called an effects test. What is that?
So the effects test is basically a requirement on big businesses to prove that their actions aren't lessening competition in the market. So farmers would be happy with this because it gives them a bit more power, I guess, in their negotiations with the two big supermarkets. But perhaps as expected, the body that represents these major retailers has rejected this test. They say that it would have a chilling effect on competition and that it would dampen pro-competitive behaviour. But Liberal backbencher Dan Tehan, who chairs the Coalition's Agricultural Backbench Committee, he says that both consumers and farmers who supply the supermarkets can benefit from the proposed changes to competition law. He says it's all about getting the balance right.
It can be both, and what we need to ensure is that if we have proper competition in the marketplace, then that not only benefits consumer, but benefits the producer as well, and that is what we are all seeking.
One of the other heavy tomes of paperwork that we had to wade through this week was the tax discussion paper released by the Treasurer, and it included a focus on wine.
An interesting thing that came out of this tax discussion paper released by Treasurer Joe Hockey was the current tax on alcohol, and it's really varied. Different types of alcohol are taxed at different rates, and this paper claims that if you're drinking a standard glass of wine out of a cask, the price of that includes just about 5 cents of tax, compared to if you were having a ready-to-drink beverage that might involve a spirit and something else ready-to-drink all mixed up together. And that includes almost a dollar of tax.
Now, That's a big difference, isn't it?
And some of the companies that make spirits are calling for a flat tax on all alcohol across the board. But Mitchell Taylor of the Winemakers Federation of Australia says that a flat tax on alcohol wouldn't be fair for winemakers.
Most of the Australian wineries at the moment are barely breaking even. Most of them aren't profitable. But this would really plunge all of them into the deep red. Half of Australia's winemakers would probably have to close down overnight. We've already got an oversupply in grapes, so it would also put pressure on the growers. A lot of growers would be forced to the wall.
It's been a very big week for the dairy industry globally, with some huge changes to how it operates in Europe.
During the week, the EU ended its milk quota system, which has been in place for 30 years, and it had been imposing a limit on the amount of milk that farmers in the EU could produce. And we saw after this quota was lifted that world dairy prices were decimated. In the first day of trading after the quotas came off, the global dairy trade, which is an online futures market for dairy, it fell about 10.8%. And that result will really concern Australian dairy farmers because milk processors here are currently working out what their next season's milk price will be when the new financial year starts.
Yes, there's a bit of nervousness around that. Are there any other reasons that we can point
to? Yeah, well, the volatility may also be attributed to what's happening in China, and news this week that China, which is the world's largest dairy buyer, is pulling back from buying whole milk powder, which is in fact the most popular sort of dairy product in the market. It's thought that China has large stocks of milk powder and it hasn't been buying as much while world dairy production has increased. New Zealand dairy company Fonterra has been hit particularly hard, and their revenue from China in the first half of the financial year was slashed by almost $2 billion. Steve Spencer is a consultant with firm Fresh Agenda, and he says Fonterra has struggled to find other markets for its milk supply.
I'd say there's a fair bit in some sheds in New Zealand to start off with. But, you know, there's increased business in the rest of Asia, the rest of the world. So they're, you know, in terms of share, they've certainly helped mitigate some of the problem by pushing elsewhere.
We've heard a little bit about banana recovery in various parts of Australia with some rough weather. There's also some news on one of Australia's largest meat processors.
JBS, which is Australia's largest meat processor, has one of its big processing plants at Rockhampton, and it was really severely damaged by Tropical Cyclone Marsha. There were sort of complicating problems there because parts of the building had asbestos, so when the cyclone came through and caused damage, there's been a big clean-up process, and no cattle have been able to be processed at that abattoir for 6 weeks, but it's on track to open next week, and JBS's John Berry says it will be business as usual after the Easter break, and they'll be having a full kill of 700 head.
Obviously, that's benefiting to hear for the producers and also the 500 employees that we'll have back to work next week. We're looking to make sure that, you know, the team gets up there and going next week and putting incomes back into their pockets, their families' pockets, and also the economy of Rockhampton.
A nice story out of WA about an innovative way of using bananas that were damaged by a cyclone.
After Cyclone Olwen went through the Gascoyne region, some of the members of a banana growers cooperative up in that area, the Sweeter Banana Co-op, they actually went out and salvaged the damaged bananas that they could, and they froze them, and now they're making banana bread out of out of the frozen bananas. Yeah, and the banana cooperative's Doriana Mangali says that the bread will provide a small amount of income to cover their costs for this foreseeable future.
We are have a packing shed we need to pay rent on and insurance and some staff that we want to keep over this period where we don't have any income, and the banana bread will help to sustain that, create us with a little bit of turnover and revenue.
Now, there are no lengths to which a sniffer dog will go to uncover something suspicious or bad.
Yeah, dogs have traditionally been trained to sniff out drugs and explosives, even missing people, but their new target could be phylloxera, which is a devastating disease that feeds on the roots of vines and can eventually kill an entire vineyard. It's been in Australia since the 1800s, and it's been a real issue for the wine industry. Now, Sonia Neitz, who's a Melbourne University viticultural and animal science researcher, has phylloxera in her sights. She says that she reckons she can train any breed of dog to be able to find phylloxera, and it would have big implications. And it doesn't need to be any sort of particular dog. Sonia says even the crazy ones will do.
In fact, the best dogs that we can use are the ones that are slightly out of control, that people think this dog is useless. That's the dog that we want. That those hyperactive, mad case dogs that you think you can't train, they're quite often the best dogs for this sort of work. They desperately need a job.
I can't imagine there's many other callings for them.
For those mad case dogs.
Yes, that's lovely. Thanks, Kath.
Thanks, Edwina.
You can find those stories online at abc.net.au/rural.
Come and get it, come and get it. Did you know that Peter Russell Clark is not just the keeper of cheese, but he's actually a UN ambassador who advocates for farmers and farming welfare? And he'll be joining other celebrity chef royals like Maggie Beer and Jeff Jans in a special edition of Breakfast on Easter Monday from 6 with me, Anne Jones, and my guest,
Peter Russell Clark.
Edwina Farley with you for A Country Breakfast. Time to join our rural reporters. This week, a little bit of culture for you as Broken Hill residents celebrate all things Italian. City slickers take up the sport of sheepdog trialling, and we meet a couple who've swapped corporate life for a pomegranate orchard in southwest Victoria. And speaking of unusual fruit, the mystery of how custard apples got their name.
Absolutely nothing like an apple and nothing like custard, except when you do open it, break it open to eat it, the flesh is quite creamy and sweet, and I suppose you could then sort of allude to maybe it's a little bit custard-like because it's creamy.
Not a bad explanation, I suppose. We'll join grower Roz Smurden for the start of the custard apple harvest a little later. But first today, the mining town of Broken Hill is celebrating its Italian heritage.
Usually stir the pot, don't they? Yes. Well, look, this is very simple. I've got garlic, fresh tomato and onions, and I'm just cooking them down so they'll go soft and that will become the base of a prawn sauce.
It's not every day that you get to hear live opera in Broken Hill or eat a three-course meal prepared by renowned chef Stefano De Pieri. But it's all happening here tonight in the far west of New South Wales.
In the end, and not cheese, to go with the orecchiette pasta. It means little ears in Italian, so it's a lovely little shape.
Hello, I'm Cherie von Hirschner. Stefano has travelled north from his home base in Mildura to bring a slice of Italian culture to local residents.
I like it because it absorbs the sauce very well. And we're here today to prepare dinner to accompany the concert by Massimo and Stefania.
Pasta that's called Little Ears, perhaps that certainly is a good start, isn't it, before the concert begins?
Yes.
Now, while classical music and Italian cuisine might seem a world away from everyday Broken Hill, there's more in common with this remote outback mining town than some people might think, with many Italian migrants making the Silver City their home since the mining boom days of the 1800s.
We have braised some lovely beef cheeks, which are hearty and very Italian, with polenta and snap peas. And then we will finish off with a basket of filo pastry with a lovely creme pâtissière scented with rose water and poached peaches. Yes, seasonal. So the main course is a bit hearty, but that's because I know the good folks of Broken Hill will like a red wine. The first course is light, and to finish a delightful summer dessert. So I'm driven by flavour. I was also thinking that our singer tonight, soprano Stefania, she has an extremely powerful voice. And I was thinking, you know, you need a big hearty dish to cope with that voice.
Hi, I'm Stefania. I'm a soprano. I come from Italy, from a small village nearby Padova, very close to Venice. I started to sing when I was 24 years old. Later, because I'm a pianist, I studied piano before, but I prefer to sing. I'm very happy to be here in Australia. For me, it's the first time, and to be in Broken Hill, because it's a very particular place. All in Australia is very different from Italy. It's very big, it's very far.
When did you realize that you wanted to sing for a living?
When I studied piano, often I play for singers, and I thought, why not? So I start to study, and now here I am.
Hi, I'm Heidi. It's great coming here tonight. Culture in Broken Hill, love it. Very exciting to have such beautiful music. I feel like it's a big treat for us.
Hello, my name's Bruce, and I'm just here tonight to experience the Italian experience, and have been to Italy a couple of times, and I just think it's important to support some local initiatives to get people out and about, and I've really enjoyed it. The meal's been good too, and the company's been fantastic as well.
Massimo Scattolin, I'm a guitarist, classical guitarist. Because it's the third time that I come here because of the friendship with Stefano. Stefano De Pieri, we are friends from a lot of years. We grew up in Italy, in the same town, Treviso. So the first time in which I arrived here, he started to talk me about Broken Hill. You have to visit Broken Hill. There is a lot of memory of migration, also some Italians. And there is a famous Italian movie with Alberto Sordi and Claudia Cardinale that was here in, I think, 40 years ago or more, I don't know. It's amazing because if you look at the movie, the thing that you are you look today is the same. Yes, the same atmosphere. So it's really a strange place. And the colors, the sky, but it's a really amazing place.
What is it about playing the classical guitar? How does that move you?
I don't know. It's something that you have inside, and you feel the necessity to play. And I'm also a composer. It's my life. I cannot do another job. I'm not able, probably.
Jack, just come here tonight because we don't get a lot of this sort of culture in Broken Hill, and you've got to support it when it comes along. Going back generations, Italians make up a lot of Broken Hill in history, so there's probably a few people here who are being reminded of home. I haven't been to too many operatic recitals anywhere, let alone in Broken Hill.
Hi, I'm Andrea. You know, just being able to experience the beautiful culture of Italy through the food and the music, it's a real thrill for us to be able to do that in Broken Hill, and we're having a great night.
Mon Angus. Mon. Stay there. Stay there. Stay there. Come by. I got a sheepdog about 14 years ago. It happened to be a French sheepdog called a Briard. And then realised he was effectively unemployed in the back garden. So I started ringing farmers and asking if they'd teach me how to use work sheep. And I got a lot of laughs, as you can imagine, and get yourself a real dog, you know.
Meet Sabina Muller-Glissman. She lives in suburban Canberra, but loves nothing more than being in a paddock with a mob of sheep teaching a collie Angus working dog skills. And he's got a lot to learn. The two of them are competing in a novice yard dog trial later this week.
Morning, Angus. And then a friend found Robert and Jenny Cox, who run working dog clinics, and they were prepared to take someone from the city and their city dog. And I've never really looked back. I've just, through them, discovered a passion for moving sheep with my dog.
Hello, I'm Michael Kavanagh. Sabina doesn't own her own property. She relies on the generosity of people like retired wool classer and dog breeder Charlie Cover to get real hands-on experience. Charlie's property is at Yass, just to the west of Canberra, in southern New South Wales. We're standing in this lovely setting at Yass, approximately 45 merino wethers, yarded by Angus. the sheep watching Angus, Angus watching the sheep. But in suburban Canberra, how can you work Angus during the week?
Well, you don't work him. A couple of things. First of all, one thing you can do in the city is keep your dog's mind stable. And that's just about having very clear black and white rules. For example, he's not allowed to go through any entrance or gateway ahead of me, because on a property you don't want the dog rushing through a gate and causing all havoc in the paddock. Secondly, it's about just letting him be, and that requires, you know, a space where they can just shut down and turn off, like a kennel or so forth, so that all helps them with their mind and just being settled and so forth. You have to keep them a little bit fit, that's for sure, but at the end of the day, nothing beats having sheep to work with, and that's why I go to a lot of effort to find places that will allow me to do a bit of work and build my skill level up. And people are very generous if you've got a willingness to learn, and I have bizarrely developed this passion at ripe old age of 48 as I am now. You know, I think if you're willing to learn, people are prepared to teach you. So whilst what you do in the city is very limited, if you've got a bit of passion and drive, I think it's like any sport, isn't it? You will go to where you get the experience you need.
And Sabina's come to the right place to improve her skills. Charlie Cover has years of experience in breeding and training working collie dogs.
I just like to look at it as a good sheep dog rather than to be too specific. Each dog will have characteristics that will need modifying. It's an instinct, and you're modifying an instinct to make it a better sheep dog. I'm a person that pays a little bit of lip service to my own work at times, and if I've got to explain it to someone else and point out to them that they're doing wrong, then you've got to be a little bit careful about what you do yourself, and I find that that's very good for me.
How much do you actually have to teach the handlers, the person that owns the dog, as opposed to people that are working with them all day, every day on a property? You have people coming out from the suburbs. Do you have to change them as well?
Definitely. And look, even the people that are on properties that want to improve their dogs, it's the person, the handler, that is the main, often the main fault, quite honestly. They don't give the dog a chance to express his natural inherited abilities, and things often can't happen fast enough for the handler. The best way I can explain it, if I see a dog improve dramatically to what he was last week, then I know straight away that the handler has improved, otherwise the dog doesn't. You modify the your expectations. I try to be honest with people. I don't tell people that they can win a sheepdog trial. It's a pretty difficult thing. Anyone that's in sheepdog trialing just for the money or the ribbons even, then it's most likely a pretty hard row. It's very, very competitive. It's very, very time consuming. And you've got three species on the ground at the one time. You've got a human, a dog and sheep. And to balance these up and have things go exactly right, put it this way, if you leave your luck at home, don't bother turning up.
This weekend, he's in the novice section.
Yes.
What do you reckon his chances are?
Oh, his chances are. I will be very, very happy if I get around. What did you say, Charlie?
Red hot favourite.
A red hot favourite. That's a friend talking. That's a good friend talking. Look, no chance to win, Michael, but it's going to be fantastic and a lot of fun, and hopefully I'll just get around with my dignity relatively intact and the sheep safe and nicely put back in the yard where they belong. Come on, Angus. Come on. Stay there. Stay there. Stay there. Come by.
And good luck to Canberra resident Sabina Mueller-Glissman and her dog Angus competing in that novice yard dog trial. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, a pomegranate tree change for a Melbourne couple, and the custard apple harvest begins in southern Queensland.
It's absolutely nothing like an apple and nothing like custard, except when you do open it, break it open to eat it, the flesh is quite creamy and sweet, and I suppose you could then sort of allude to maybe it's a little bit custard-like because it's creamy, but not crunchy like an apple, nothing like that. So I'm not really sure where that name came from.
Custard apples, the strange knobbly green fruit from Peru with an equally strange name.
A bit of a strange beast, I suppose you could say, like nothing else that you've ever seen. They have a reasonably symmetrical shape, but are quite pointy and bumpy until they get really, really ripe, where they start to smooth out.
G'day, I'm Marty McCarthy. Queensland grows around half of Australia's custard apples, and this year's harvest is getting underway here on Ros Smurden's farm at the Glasshouse Mountains, just to the north of Brisbane on the Sunshine Coast. Just don't expect to see many in the shops around here. It appears Queenslanders balk at paying top dollar for a fruit they can pick in their own backyard.
So this custard apple here is ready to be harvested. As you can see, the colours are much lighter. It's gone a bit of a yellowy green colour as opposed to the darker green of the other fruit that's still a few weeks away. So this will go back to the shed. It'll be washed, put in the cold room overnight until we get the pulp temperature down between 8 and 10 degrees. And then it'll be packed back in the cold room on a pallet and off to market somewhere in either Australia or Singapore or Malaysia.
And they can get quite large as well, up to over a kilogram.
Yes, well, a lot of fruit is around that, somewhere between 700-800 grams to up to, say, 1.2 kilos. The biggest we've ever had is 1.9 kilos, which was just monstrous. Quite often, yeah, you're looking at more than a kilo. And that really suits, say, some of the Asian destinations because those markets are used to where they get a big piece of fruit and they share it with their family, whereas in Australia we tend to have a piece of fruit that we'll eat ourselves.
But interestingly, the fruit you supply mainly goes from southeast Queensland to Melbourne and Adelaide. Why not Brisbane?
I guess Brisbane or in Queensland, everyone's just so used to being able, you know, they've either got a tree in the backyard or they can get it on the side of the road, you know, quite cheaply. And they're not prepared to pay the higher value that's required for really good quality fruit like what we produce. And we find that with the relationships we've built with those our markets in the other states, we get a lot more in return for our fruit.
We're standing out amongst the trees now and it's hot. I'm sweating. There's a slight breeze, but not enough to cool me down. What type of conditions do the custard apples need to grow?
Well, when they're flowering, you need to get humidity. This or last season, like sort of that November period, it was quite dry and hot and we didn't have any rainfall at that time. So that early fruit didn't set and that's why the season's a little bit later this year because it wasn't setting until December when we started to get the rain. But when it comes to harvest time, you can guarantee that come late March, early April, it'll be raining. So right now we're sweating and, you know, dying. It's 35 plus, and in a couple of weeks it'll be raincoats on and just slogging it out through the rain. The fruit doesn't wait, so we still have to pick when it's raining, otherwise it'll fall off and fall on the ground and then it's unsaleable. So it's either heat or pouring rain. It's just the way it goes.
And then so once it's picked, it's off to the packing shed.
The shed hand.
We've taken a walk into the packing shed now. I'm here with Philip Tucker. He's washing the custard apples and then getting them ready to be packed.
Yeah, that's right. We put them on the wheel here and they go around and they're high pressure sprayed and cleaned. Then we take them off and put them on the sorting table here. And then they're weighed. Every bit of fruit is weighed and graded and sorted and stacked in a certain section and then boxed and put in the freezer, ready for the women for packing.
They're not a smooth fruit. There's lots of bumps and crevices in them. Is it difficult to get all the dirt out?
No. The dirt that may remain in there is blown out with the high-pressure hose here, and that cleans them pretty well.
So that's the noise we can hear in the background, yep. Spraying out all that dirt.
Yep. There we go.
So you use water and the air to get rid of it.
Water spray. There's jets in here. You can hear the jets here. Inside the cabinet. You can see the fruit goes around on the wheel and the high pressure water sprays clean the fruit and they circulate for a couple of times and then come out and on the table, as I said earlier.
How important is it to have a fresh, green, clean looking custard apple?
Oh, well, I suppose appearance is everything, isn't it? You know, if it looks good, people want to buy it.
The sign hanging on the gate here at Steve and Evelyn Ord's property reads Senna Grove. Senna stands for Steve and Ev's next adventure and perfectly sums up this couple's approach to life. Hello, I'm Danny Grindley in Eden Hope in the southwest corner of Victoria. Before the Ords moved to this rich cropping area, they were living in Melbourne. Steve running his own business and Evelyn scurrying around the corporate market world in a suit and high heels. Then one night they took out a map, chose Eden Hope as the town smack bang in the middle of Melbourne and Adelaide and decided to move to the district, initially to run the Lake Wallace Caravan Park.
I think we drank too much port one night, didn't we?
Yeah.
No, we were both looking for... I wanted to get out of the corporate market because I've been there for years and travelling interstate and overseas. It was getting too much and, yeah.
Well, you're far too young for that to have been a retirement plan or anything. Could we call it a midlife crisis at that point, 10 years ago?
Just about. It was semi-retirement. Like, you can't call a caravan park a retirement because it's 24/7 and it's not all roses when you've got to clean someone else's toilet.
After exactly 5 years, 5 weeks and 5 days of cleaning toilets, the caravan park was passed on to new owners. It was time for Steve and Ev's next adventure.
The first four rows are a different variety, so they're actually smaller.
We wanted to find something that was high yielding, that would make us a good income, and something that would actually grow in this area with the soil type and the rainfall and all that sort of thing. Mm. And yeah, pomegranates was sort of being discovered by MasterChef at the time, so researched that and that's what we sort of came down to.
Are they being grown in this area anywhere else?
When we started researching, 95% were imported from California. So that's why we thought it was a really good thing to go for, because it was actually replacing the import market.
I think it's a fruit that's just been overlooked. It's one of the oldest fruits known to man sort of thing, and it just lost favour or flavour. Everyone had has got a grandmother that had a pomegranate tree in their backyard, and it was all ornamental. People think back and, yeah, I grew up and I used to shoot them with the slug gun and all that sort of thing. They were just fair game. And no one ever thought about eating them.
It's a Mediterranean plant, and a lot of our areas are good with the Mediterranean type products.
Describe the process for me. Once you decide, okay, pomegranates is it.
Once we decided it was pomegranates, it was a matter of sourcing the trees to start with because we didn't know who grew them. Then it was just a matter of getting a bulldozer in. We ripped the rows down 3 feet. We limed them the hard way. Everything, if we can possibly do it the hard way, we do, which is very unfortunate. Poor old Ev ended up with burns all over her body after being covered in lime dust and sweating.
Oh, no.
We're so green. I mean, we've got so much good advice from the horticulturists and the irrigation guys.
Yeah.
But I think the local people still think we're nuts.
It's all broadacre farming up here, and unless you're growing sheep for wool, because we've got Dorpers that have got hair, they call them our goats.
Yeah, they don't fit in around here, mate.
No, we're the nutters out the road with the trees in the paddock next to the house. The average person will walk in and go, this isn't an orchard.
It's been 3 years since the nutters planted their 320 pomegranate trees. But if all goes to plan, they're the ones who will be laughing. This isn't a hobby. There's a clear business plan. And this year is the first time their plants will bear fruit.
We'll probably get, it's reckon about 400 pieces this year, which is enough to play with. We want to actually just test things like cryovacking and the different things that you can actually make from it so you can have an end product from it, not just the whole fruit. And enough to, you know, just experiment with cooking, because we want to do a little book that goes out with our first harvest, which we hope will be next year, if there's no locusts and if there's no floods, if everything goes in our favour.
Steve, you're obviously writing this recipe book, are you?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
All right. It is yours, okay.
But they're family secrets. I'd have to kill you if I told you.
So right. Have you experimented with pomegranates much?
Well, we've learnt how to make beautiful cocktails.
Yeah.
Very, very important. Brilliant in salads, you know, with honey and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
So, but now we have more to do, so I'm actually looking forward to it. In about a month's time, we should be pulling them off the trees.
See, until now, we really haven't done a lot of chasing up the wholesale market yet because we're waiting for them to grow. We're just biding our time at the moment.
How much would you get for fresh pomegranates these days? Does that change? Does it fluctuate?
It has a little bit.
Yeah.
It's last year they were still getting, and it depends where you go, between $3 and $5 a fruit.
Initially, when we worked everything out, wholesale price was $2 a fruit. We sort of still stick on that, even though all those figures are like 5 years old now. That way you're not overshooting the mark sort of thing.
If this is highly successful and there's all this demand for your new pomegranate jam, will you expand? Is that part of the plan?
It could well be, yeah. We've still got more land here. This is going to be a good income for us. When it's a mature tree, after about 5-6 years, you're looking around about 150 to 200 fruit per tree, at $2 each at a wholesale market. Yeah, it's our super fund out there. Steve and Evelyn Ord and their latest adventure, setting up a commercial pomegranate orchard in the southwest of Victoria. Danny Grindlay, the reporter there. I'm Edwina Farley and this is A Country Breakfast on RN. This morning we're having an Easter treat. We'll take a tour of the Hague's chocolate factory in Adelaide and find out what goes into biodynamic winemaking in a vineyard in Canberra.
This month, the very best Australian drama is at your fingertips with iView.
My name's Jack Irish.
Every episode of some of the most powerful and celebrated series.
I'd tread very carefully if I were you.
All in the one place.
Well, what are we waiting for?
Discover what you've missed. Relive what you loved.
He has a chance for something real.
Binge on the very best Australian drama this month.
This is big.
Go to iview.abc.net.au or download the app now.
Easter feasting in a moment, but first, quad bike safety is once again in the spotlight with two coronial inquests underway in Queensland and New South Wales and inquests in Victoria and Tasmania to follow. The coroners will hear contested evidence about the best ways to improve quad bike safety. There's a long-standing disagreement between the industry and safety researchers, and there's a lot at stake. The United States industry, which makes most of Australia's quad bikes, is watching closely what happens here. Anne Arnold has made a background briefing documentary which goes to air tomorrow on Radio National. This excerpt begins with 11-year-old David in the far north Queensland town of Malanda.
I used to have a quad when I was like little, when I was 4 or 5. I had a little Honda 50 and I used to go riding about all the time just around the front yard. And we only had the occasional 1-2 stacks. And so now I've gone back up to two-wheelers. I have a 1-2 DRZ Suzuki 125 now.
And where do you ride that?
I just ride that out in my place. We've got 3 acres to ride in, got a big paddock.
Would you be wanting a quad bike in the future, do you think?
Oh, not necessarily. They're a bit more dangerous than two-wheelers because they can flip a lot easier if you go around corners and stuff.
Deaths from quad bike accidents are reportedly the biggest killer on Australian farms. There have been over 200 deaths since 2001. New research from the University of New South Wales finds that half the fatalities happened while working and half recreationally, on farms and elsewhere. There have been thousands of injuries over the same period.
Dominic actually suffered a severe brain injury. He had a bleed to the right side of his frontal lobe and fractured his skull from the back right through to almost his nose. That fracture just missed one of the main arteries that flows up into your brain. He had no other broken bones and I picked him up off the road and ran up to the house and we called then 000.
Dominic's accident was a collision, but 70% of the deaths since the year 2000 involved rollovers. A quad bike typically weighs around 300 kilos. If it rolls, the rider can be crushed and asphyxiated. Early last year, a group coronial inquest got underway in Queensland. The Queensland inquest is investigating 9 deaths. It resumes hearings this month. A New South Wales inquest began in February and is investigating 8 deaths. Other coronial inquests are scheduled for Tasmania and Victoria later this year. It could be crunch time for quad bikes. The coroners will be assessing proposals to make the vehicles safer through changes to design. And a controversial safety star rating system is under consideration. The industry will resist these moves. It argues that the focus should be on changing rider behaviour. Be sensible, don't put children on bikes, don't overload a farm bike. The industry says these issues are more important than quad bike design.
There's been a large number of factors in the deaths in ATVs.
James Hernall is the technical director of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which represents most of the Australian quad bike distributors.
Some of the people who've been killed, unfortunately, were under the influence of alcohol, for example. Some of them may have not had the same tragic end if they'd been wearing a helmet. So just saying the vehicle is unstable, I think, is a big reach.
Of course the manufacturers don't like it when their product winds up being involved in a fatality. Of course they don't want that happening. But they see a particular solution. They keep talking about the stupid rider. It's blame the driver syndrome again.
Professor Raphael Gibierta is a veteran quad bike researcher from the University of New South Wales. He's led a large study which is at the centre of the two coronial inquests.
Yes, people do silly things, but does that mean it has to be a death penalty or a wheelchair for them? What we're saying is you can design these systems to better handling characteristics, better stability, better restraint in a rollover. The problem is they want emphatic proof. They want perfection. They want everything dotted and underlined before we turn around and say, well, it's got to be designed to this specification.
There's been an impasse between the industry and safety proponents. The American quad bike market makes up 90% of the world market. So the needs and views of the American industry carry a lot of weight. Designing different vehicles for different markets would be complicated and expensive for the industry. And if Australia were to run with a different set of design rules, there may be legal implications in the US.
Well, there is a doctrine in liability law that says that manufacturers should adopt state-of-the-art when they're making their products. So if somebody could show that there was a safety feature or a safety approach in Australia that was freely available to manufacturers in the United States, that could be a factor in liability cases.
Bob Adler is a commissioner with the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission in the United States. Commissioner Adler says that precedents could be set in Australia.
Well, I think that everybody in the United States, certainly I include myself in that, follows what's going on in Australia. So Australia is setting precedents that can be argued to apply in the United States, and I have a feeling that what takes place in Australia is monitored by American manufacturers, and they take that into account.
Bob Adler, one of five commissioners with the US Consumer Product Safety Commission. And you can hear Anne's full report on Background Briefing tomorrow on RN just after the 8 o'clock news. In the Canberra region, Cool Climate Wine District winemakers are talking about a great season, with most of them with most harvesting complete. One of the last to pick is Dr. Dave Carpenter, a former physicist and mathematician who for over two decades has been a successful winemaker. He had held off from picking till what is known as the Fruit Day period, which is spread over 3 days as part of the lunar cycle. Standing amidst his vines, he explained to Michael Kavanagh, producing wine, according to the cycle, is part of biodynamics.
It's special because it is a lovely day and the fruit is ripe and ready to go. On top of that, we are at about a three-quarter moon, so that we're well away from unwelcome influences from a full moon. We're away from an impending lunar eclipse. Also, it's apogee, so the moon's influence is minimal. We see that as a way to make sure we have good concentration in the fruit.
Biodynamics was largely the work of the philosopher Rudolf Steiner. Then it was picked up by a German woman, Maria Thun, and it's worked out on four different things, such as the root day, the leaf day, the flower day, and the fruit day. You're in the middle of the three-day cycle of the fruit day. What does that mean for picking?
The work that Maria Thun carried out showed that as the moon transited through the planetary alignments, there were various influences on plants that either led to good root development or good leaf development, fruit development or flower development. And we take that on board and we really want to pick on a fruit day. As a secondary opportunity, we would also pick on flower days. This is probably the third stage of selecting a day for harvesting. We look for those days and we recognise that the work that Maria Thun carried out did give some very clear results.
The 3 days that you've got to pick, does that mean that only the picking is any good within those 3 days?
No, I think it means that these are days that we would prefer to pick on. We feel that these days are when we would see the fruit at its best.
So there's the fruit day and the flower day. That's good for both tasting and picking. The other 2 days, the root day and the leaf day, what role do they play in the making of wine?
We're not so much talking about the making of wine here. We're going back to planting. So if we are planting new vines, we would want to plant on a root day because we'd want to see good root development. That would be our preference.
Dave, how strictly do you follow the three-day cycle, for example, on the fruit day for picking? If the fruit is very close to being ready to be picked, but it falls outside of the fruit day. Will you pick, or how long do you have to wait again?
Well, we have the luxury here in the Canberra district of relatively slow ripening. So if the fruit is not really quite ready, we can easily hold off until the next sequence of fruit days, or perhaps the next sequence of flower days, which would be closer. So it's not a big issue.
How much does it also influence you on the making of the wine? Once you've taken the fruit off, does it also play a role in the wine itself?
Interestingly, there are some wine making processes which appear to be sensitive to these sorts of patterns as well, and there are plenty of biodynamic winemakers who rigidly adhere to this calendar for certain winery activities, such as racking juice off solids or initiating a ferment or perhaps putting wine into barrels. There are some things in the winery that carry over.
How much also do the specific days, such as the flower day or the fruit day, play a role not just in when to pick, but the types of wine as well? For example, I understand Riesling goes better on some days than others.
Well, I think if you're looking at an aromatic variety like Riesling, you might prefer to pick on a flower day, perhaps with the intention of optimising aroma. Whereas if you're picking something like Chardonnay, where you are really looking for depth of fruit character, then fruit days would be the go.
What about then, that we're standing here between two rows, and on the right is the Shiraz. So that's a red. How different would that be when it comes to the different lunar days?
Well, I think picking the Shiraz on a fruit day is spot on. And the Viognier on our left that we're going to be picking today, part of it is destined for our Rhone blend, which is our Mr. V, and that's quite a full-on rich style. So fruit character is of the essence.
This is an area that's relatively young when it comes to winemaking. There are a lot of people like yourself with academic backgrounds. In the use of biodynamics, where does it stand with a lot of the other winemakers when you're discussing the merits of your wine, and you've been in it now for more than two decades? Is there a little bit of resistance?
Well, let me say that a few years ago, Sue and I went to a workshop on vineyard practices. We were asked to talk about biodynamics, and we felt that we were perhaps going to be held up to ridicule or close to it. And we were amazed to find that even large vineyard managers were adopting, or at least recognising, biodynamic principles. And one of the reasons for this was to get away from the dependence on toxic chemicals. And if you're running a very large vineyard, those toxic chemicals are also very expensive. So by adopting some of these principles, these people were not only perhaps working with their vineyards better, but they were saving money.
Being Easter, we're also coming up to an eclipse. What sort of role would an eclipse play both in picking and winemaking?
I think we would not do very much on an eclipse day. We might watch the eclipse.
And sit down and savour the delights of a previous vintage?
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds good. Yeah.
And that's Canberra winemaker Dr. Dave Carpenter. Now, it wouldn't be Easter weekend without talking chocolate, and one of Australia's oldest chocolate factories has hit its peak production period, making the most of Australians indulging in Easter treats. Adelaide-based Hague's Chocolates, which is marking 100 years of operation next month, produces hundreds of tonnes of chocolate each year with Australian-grown sugar and milk powder. Chief Executive Alistair Hague says the company's annual sales are increasing as the country's population increases.
We're making about 700 tonnes of chocolate a year, and so for that, and for our other sugar requirements, we probably use about the same amount of sugar. So there's about 700 tonnes of sugar, and I'd guess probably about 200 tonnes of milk powder.
And the majority of that would be sourced from Australia, except for the cocoa?
Oh, absolutely. Our policy is to source products wherever possible locally, and then Australia, and then if not, sort of Australasia. So definitely we use Queensland sugar, well, Australian sugar, most of it's Queensland, but some might be from New South Wales, and definitely it's Australian milk powder.
So over behind us, the chocolate is effectively already made, but in this particular factory it goes into the moulds and the fillings are added, is that right?
That's right. This is basically the finishing plant, so we have the bulk liquid chocolate coming up here, and then the finished product then is made here and goes back to our warehouse.
Just behind us we can see some nuts being crushed up. Would they be local too?
Again, wherever possible, we're using Australian products. In fact, the line we just came past, there was a new line using walnuts because we've just been able to source Australian walnuts for the first time. So absolutely, we use Australian products wherever possible.
You do source cocoa from parts of the Pacific, I believe, and you have considered getting some cocoa from Vanuatu.
Yes, we're looking at that. Papua New Guinea has been a big supplier for us for many years, and sort of, I guess just over the last few years that the Pacific Islands have taken some interest in growing cocoa again, and we've been working quite closely with the Vanuatu growers to help them get reliable and good quality cocoa that we can consider using. So we're hopeful that in the near future we'll have some Vanuatu beans in our warehouse.
It might have taken a setback for the time being with the cyclone.
It might have, but we're receiving reports that on the whole it hasn't been damaged too much because cocoa grows on trees and it's a tropical tree, so it's a bit like palm trees. They're sort of designed to handle fairly tough storms, but there probably has been a little bit of damage, but it hasn't been too bad.
Obviously a good export opportunity for somewhere like Vanuatu, but what about the cocoa that's grown in Australia? Would you take more Australian cocoa if it was available?
We'd look at it as an adjunct, but the Australian cocoa would never replace any of the traditional beans that we're using because they have a certain flavour profile, and Australia is quite different, and that's why we get beans from all around the world, because every country has a different flavour profile. So we wouldn't use it to substitute any of those because that would alter our flavours of our traditional chocolates, but we'd probably use it as bringing in an additional line to sell.
As we walk further through the factory here, Alistair, this is basically where the fillings are made.
That's right. We call this the kitchen area. So and we call it a kitchen because we actually do make it in batches. So as you saw when we walked past, there were two batches of marshmallow there, and there's various batches lying around in racks and everything else for processing. And so it's all cooked here, either in steam pans or on a gas fire. So it is just a big version of a kitchen.
This is the busiest time of year, though. It doesn't get much more hectic than this.
No, it is crazy time. We've got an extra production line, being the Easter line, that's running. And then at the warehouse, we have to store not the Easter product, but a lot of that is air. So volume-wise, it's probably 2-3 times the amount of space we require at Easter rather than Christmas.
Is the chocolate game still a profitable business?
Well, Hagues is profitable, so most of the companies in the chocolate business are private companies, so it's a bit hard to sort of evaluate what they're doing. But there's a lot that are expanding, but there are a lot that are disappearing. So it's like any manufacturing, some are finding it fairly tough, so it's difficult. But Hagues is profitable, and the big companies seem to be reporting good profits as well that are publicly listed, so on the whole, it is a profitable industry.
100 years for Hagues operating this coming May. It must be a proud moment for the family-owned business.
Well, it is. It's a milestone. But I guess because we've been around for so long, we sort of almost take it for granted a bit. So I think sort of people on the outside of the business will probably react more than we will, because we've just lived and breathed it for so long anyway.
Hagues Chocolates Chief Executive Alistair Hagues speaking with the very lucky Carl Curtin at the company's Adelaide factory. That's it from the Country Breakfast team for this week. Thanks to Richard Girvan for technical production. You can check out the giant chocolate bilby online or find out more about biodynamic winemaking at abc.net.au/rural. I'm Edwina Farley. Stay with us on RN.